Welcome to Phantom Island, presented by Homefield. It's me, one of your co-hosts, Ryan Nanny, and today I am not with my usual partner, Stephen Godfrey, but instead I'm going to be joined by Roger Sherman, author of the delightful Read Raj newsletter, which you can find a link to in our show notes. Before I get rolling with Raj, I have a thank you and a request. If you are one of the many paid subscribers who have supported Phantom Island thus far, thank you for helping Stephen and I get this show up and running. If you haven't, thanks for listening all the same, and you can always go to phantomisland.show to get access to all of the episodes we produce. And the quick request. If you would, please leave us a review on whatever podcast platform you're listening to Phantom Island on, or text a friend you think might like the show. Word of mouth really helps, and we really appreciate it. Okay, let's bring Roger on to talk Ivy League football.
Every rustle in the trees, a potential snare. Close my eyes and block my ears.
Roger Sherman, have you ever heard of what Harvard calls the broken leg test?
Not specifically. I imagine if you were talking about like a medical test, it'd be pretty easy.
You're like, you mean x-rays. You're talking about x-rays.
You're talking about x-rays. Like, or like ask the person to walk and if their leg is broken, they'll probably say, ow.
Maybe.
Because leg is a big thing to break. Or that, or what's the thing where they hit you with a little tuning fork?
You mean the reflex test?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not what you're talking about.
No, it's not. It's not. In fact, this is not, in some sense, this is not a medical test at all. This has to do with athlete admissions at Harvard. So we will get into the nitty-gritty of this, but let's start from the very basic premise, which I think some listeners to this podcast may not know. And that is that Harvard, like the rest of the Ivy League, does not offer athletic scholarships. That is not, you cannot get into any of these schools via, oh, I got an offer to play basketball, lacrosse, football, whatever. So you go through the normal admissions cycle to some extent. There is a degree to which athletics sort of gets to be part of the process and sort of indicate like, hey, here's an athlete we're interested in. They might need, you know, an earlier decision because they're looking at other places and they have different deadlines than academic only students, whatever. But the broken leg test, as described by the Dean of Admissions in an interview with the Harvard Crimson in 2024, is very simple. If a recruited athlete, quote, breaks her leg in five places and never plays, is she still someone whom you'll be excited about? And the answer has to be yes. I don't think any college football team in FBS, including the academically oriented ones, Northwestern, for instance, where you went to school, I don't think they use the broken leg test when they're recruiting football players, personally.
Yeah, most of the time it's like there's sort of a, do we feel this person can survive here, like restriction, maybe even a little less than that, like sure. Where they make it a little bit easier, but it's like, we still want the person to somewhat uphold what we do academically at a place like you said, Northwestern or Stanford or Rice or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, not 100% of the way, like they must be a part of every they must hit every facet.
Yes. And there's certainly a sense of, I think, a very open sense of like athletes, scholarship athletes at other schools are being recruited with that as like a major reason for them to come to that school. And I don't have any problem with that. But it's interesting to look at Harvard, where at least on its face, the standard seems to be, would you be a valuable addition to the Harvard community and a proud member of our future alums if you never played a second of your chosen sport, if you walked in on day one and you were immediately medically disqualified?
I mean, at like an SEC school or something like that, they'd be like, this guy broke his leg. We hate him. That guy didn't pan out at all.
Yeah.
He showed up, he broke his leg, and it was a big disappointment. He was a four-star recruit. We were expecting to play wide receiver.
Traitorous tibia. That's what we call him. That's his name from now on. So the reason I'm talking about the broken leg rule is that you have, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Is it a theory? Is it a proposal? Is it a outlandish claim? Like, how would you like to frame what we're going to talk about? And then we'll sort of fill in the pieces around it.
I'm always a little bit fascinated by Ivy League sports. I actually come from Columbia football stock. One of my, I believe, cousins or maybe uncles on my mom's side played at Columbia in the 1960s. My wife recently got her master's and her doctorate from Columbia. I'm very proud of her. And we went to a Columbia football game together. And then I went to one solo last year just because I could take the subway to a football game. I thought that was cool. And it's sort of strange. The way Ivy League football works, because Ivy League people and Ivy League schools have this big superiority complex. They strive to be the best in everything. And in so many ways they are. They have the biggest endowments in sports. They have the biggest endowments by far of any colleges. They have the highest academic standards, et cetera, et cetera. And they used to have the highest football standards as well. Yeah. They won most of the championships in the first few decades of the sport. And then eventually they decided they weren't going to compete in top level football and stopped doing that, which makes sense. But the weird thing to me is like, they didn't just say, okay, we're done with football. They have continued to play football just like a little bit, like in the FCS, without particularly competitive teams. They have, until this coming year, not even participated in the college, in the FCS playoffs.
Yeah.
So just have not allowed their football teams to win championships. And it's very strange for them to exist in this sort of, yeah, like, we'll be okay at that sport. And what I wonder is, in a sport that is increasingly ruled by money, why don't the Ivy Leagues take that money, which they already spend on many things to make their college's reputation good and high, and you know, dominate college football?
So let's set the stage here a little bit here. Roger's right that these are schools that, like, if you go look up the list of, you know, schools with the most national championships recognized by the NCAA, you're going to be like, oh, there are a lot of schools up here that are not, you know, in the Big Ten, in the SEC. It's a lot of old Ivy League titles.
The school with the most national championship claims is Princeton. With 28, which is so many claims. They're also the school with the most, Yale is the school with the most NCAA recognized national championships. They have 18, then it's Alabama with 16, and then it's Princeton with 15, which means Princeton is BSing about almost half of their. Like 15 out of 28 are NCAA recognized.
But 15 is still a lot of national. Even if we're saying,
yes,
we're ignoring all your claimed ones, we're only giving you credit for the NCAA acknowledgments. 15 is still a lot, especially when you're like, oh, you're not. It's not like you were the outlier. You were the only school up here who cared about football. Lots of these schools have national titles. The other thing that's interesting is that even to this day, with the way in which the Ivy Leagues have conducted their, not just their football teams, but their athletic departments as a whole, you still see Ivy Leaguers make the NFL relatively regular. Like Ryan Fitzpatrick, I think, was sort of the like cliche example. But according to ESPN, there are 14 Ivy players in the NFL right now. Harvard and Yale each have 4. And you can find FBS schools that don't have that, like, FIU doesn't have 4 players in the NFL. And certainly, like, without any shade to the Panthers, I certainly don't think that's because FIU is like, well, we conduct our athletic department the exact same way the Ivy Leagues do.
I think Ryan Fitzpatrick going to Harvard is like the number one sports announcer fact of all time.
Oh, it's really high up there. Certainly in the NFL. Yeah.
If you have any sports announcer facts you'd like to share with the crowd.
There was the stretch where every Texas game, it would get mentioned that it felt like it didn't matter who it was. Quarterback and wide receiver were roommates. That was really important to talk about for some reason.
But Ryan Fitzpatrick, Harvard, was number one. And it's not just the players. Like, you have Mike McDaniel, the coach of the Dolphins, went to Yale, played at Yale. Josh Grizzard, the new offensive coordinator for the Buccaneers, went to Yale. Like, Jason Garrett went to Princeton, the longtime Cowboys coach. There's, like, a pretty surprising amount of Ivy League influence in the – and not bad players a lot of
right.
the time.
Right.
Like, there is talents coming out of those programs that even though they choose to operate in a way that's totally unlike everyone else in the sport. I think there were two players drafted last year. The one that comes to mind right off the top of my head – is Foye Oluokun on the Jaguars mm-hmm. who went to Yale. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if he's the number one Yale NFL player right now, but there's like it happens pretty regularly.
Marcellus Wiley played at Columbia.
Yeah.
And had a great NFL career.
Yeah, like and it's so weird because like I've now been to Columbia's stadium. And it's hard for me to imagine. I've seen Columbia's athletic facilities. It's hard for me to imagine how a player got to the NFL from there. But also on top of that, not just like the facilities, but also like choosing to play there mm-hmm. out of every place in the country. If you have the type of athleticism and talent to make the NFL, you go to a place that does not offer athletic scholarships. And now that becomes even more of a thing because now schools are able to pay players.
Yes.
The House settlement allows schools to pay players about $20 million total from all things. And you would think, wow, this is like great for the Ivy Leagues because they are so rich. They have so much money. They are loaded. And they decided they wanted no part of that. They decided this was not going to be a thing that they would participate in. I mean, they're still not giving the players athletic scholarships, so I guess it shouldn't be too surprising. There's just this ethos that they don't want anyone there who's receiving any incentive. They should want to be at the Ivy League school because of it. They should want to do things the right way. But at a certain point, it feels to me like you are choosing to be like unhelpful to the players who have chosen this path. You know, like if you're saying these players, they're talented, they're academically capable enough to go to these schools, they've chosen to go here and take part in these hard courses. And then you're also saying you can't have the basic things that players at other schools have on top of that. Just seems unnecessary to me. I should note that in a lot of these schools, needs-based aid kicks in. Like if you're making under $200,000, if your family makes under $200,000, your tuition at Harvard is zero because they just have such a big endowment. That's the way they've chosen it mm-hmm. instead of what I proposed, which is building a huge football practice facility and getting 5 stars. Yeah. But like that's still a decent way to use it, making the school free for. So that does kick in and that has made it, I think, possible for these teams to have some players that, you know, wouldn't have been able to attend the schools otherwise, but it's still, you're putting them down a lot.
Maybe I think of it as sort of like, you remember that throwback baseball league that Conan O'Brien went and did a piece with forever
yes.
ago?
That, yes.
Yeah. I look at this as similar to that, as sort of like, we have decided to play it by the rules as they existed 100 years ago. And that means we're not like we've touched on this in other productions, but like the idea of giving athletes scholarships at all within the NCAA was incredibly contentious. This was a long time ago that it was contentious, but just the idea across the sport, just the idea that like anybody was going to get anything for playing a sport offended the sensibilities of people who thought you should be a student first, second, and third. And if you happen to be good at football and want to play football, that should be the case. Like, I will say this for the Ivy League. There are no half measures here. Like, they won't do academic scholarships. They've opted out of house, which is, like, there are other FCS programs that have opted out of house, but it's certainly not the majority of them. They only are allowing NIL to take place because basically federal judges said you can't eliminate an athlete's name, image, and likeness opportunities. So they sort of have their hands tied there. But I'm sure if it were just up to them, they would say, no, you can't take endorsement money because of your athletic blah, blah, blah. Like, there is a consistency to it, I guess. If you hold to the belief that, like, being a student should be the most important thing and football should come second, as should any other sport, like, they are, as much as you probably can in 2025, they are walking that line. I don't necessarily agree with the line, but, like, I don't think it's bullshit, if that makes sense.
I like that you've brought up old-timey baseball.
Okay.
Because I have here a quote from Charles William Eliot, the Harvard president from the 1860s up through the beginning of the 20th century, for the longest tenure president in school history. Was not a fan of sports, was not a fan of football, basketball, hockey, spoke on it regularly. And this quote, I feel like, defines the Ivy League sports vibe. I believe it's from 1905. He says, "This year I'm told the team did well because one pitcher had a fine curveball. I understand that a curveball is thrown with a deliberate attempt to deceive. Surely this is not an ability we should want to foster at Harvard." And it's one of my new favorite quotes. First of all, Chuck, if you don't mind me calling you Chuck, let's talk about pitch sequencing. Like, it's not necessarily an attempt to deceive. It's like, you know, hitting those pitches as a skill.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have...
I don't know. I like that my interpretation of this is Chuck was like, it's all gas all day. One finger down. That's all I want to see.
He's saying we want dudes throwing 101.
That's right.
Fastballs every day.
That's right. I'll tell you it's coming. I'll tell you it's a fastball in the outside corner. Let's see if you can
That is, I believe, that was the follow-up quote after that.
Yeah, that's right.
He said, I want our boys breaking the radar gun.
That's right.
But it's like, it is true, I think, this throwback like spirit. I mean, if you go to the places where Ivy League football teams play and some Ivy League basketball teams, they are like these like crumbling palaces from like the 1920s and the 1930s. The Yale Bowl seats 70,000. Harvard Stadium, I think, used to seat 50, 60. Penn plays at the Palestra in basketball, which is like a castle. And they play at Franklin Field in football, which the Eagles used to play there. And it has there are all these like neoclassical buildings. And they're like, if Aaron Rodgers saw them, he would be like, there used to be an ancient civilization that lived here. And we don't talk about it. And like, it's, and they've, I'm not much in the same way they keep those old buildings, which they do because it would be very expensive to replace. Like, yeah, they literally have stuck with the bad exploitative rules, but you're right. They were not doing it. It feels like out of a sense of, it almost feels like some of the things we criticized the NCAA for so long, like, look at them. They are, you know, pretending that there's no money in this, but meanwhile, they're making money hand over fist. Like in a messed up way, the Ivy League just didn't do that part. Like, yeah. You know, they were like, there's an honesty to their backwardsness.
And to be clear, I don't even think that's necessarily like, oh, how chivalrous of them or whatever. Harvard doesn't need, you know, Fox's college football money. They have plenty of money coming in from other places. And I think they have decided, and lots of lots of officials at these schools have sort of said, like, we don't want to open up that pipeline because of what it would require us to, like, we don't want the trade-off of going big time in these sports. And I think, like, they're at a real crossroads right now, because to some extent, if you're the Ivy League, you can say, like, well, here's how we're going to do things. And we don't care if, like, we, you know, it hurts our recruiting or this, that, or the other. Like, it's important for us. This is the way we want our world to work. But other parts of it, they can't control. The transfer portal is a good example.
Yes.
Several prominent basketball players in the Ivy League have gotten plucked and gone to, you know, schools like Michigan and Georgetown. And that, it strikes me that maybe one of the limitations of the Ivy League's approach is that their conservatism will grow even starker as the rest of the sport sort of modernizes, and may leave them with all of the downside or all of the challenges that you have to deal with in the modern college sports environment, and a decision not to take advantage of any of the sort of like levers you can pull to counterbalance those. Like, if you're going to say, we don't do scholarships and we're out of house, like, your transfer portal strategy is basically like, well, we'll sell you on the value of the degree, and that's it.
It's the one that really stands out to me is that the Ivy League, unusually among all the conferences, I don't think any other conference does this, does not allow players to participate as graduate students, which has become a pretty common way of players extending their career into the, you know, 5th, 6th, 7th, 11th, 13th years of eligibility. But like they're pretty hard line on it, and it keeps, and they won't even allow you to say if you take a redshirt season due to injury or this was an issue during COVID, like they still won't allow you to play that fifth year. And oftentimes it's the stars of these programs, players who you'd think are upholding all the values that we're talking about. You know, they're players who go to the school, go there for 4 years, don't transfer, don't take NIL money, graduate, and hypothetically get accepted to a graduate program. Why wouldn't you allow that person to keep playing? Like some pretty prominent examples of that happening over and over again. On your WNBA roster size episode, you talked about Caitlin Chen. She played 4 years at Princeton, was a really solid player for them, ran out of eligibility, transferred to UConn, and won a national championship there in her fifth year. There's a player right now who's going to play wide receiver for Duke this year, Cooper Barkate, who is, according to 24/7 Sports, the highest rated recruit in Harvard history since they started tracking. He was a 3-star recruit. Last year, he was a second team All-American. He graduated from Harvard in 3 years and now is playing for Duke because they don't allow you to keep playing if you are a graduate student. I think he may have also wanted to transfer up to a higher level. Like maybe he could have stretched his, you know, studies out to 4 years. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if he wanted to continue playing, but that's like a rule where it's like, even the players who are doing everything right, you are still adding this unnecessary restriction that doesn't even seem to stand up to the, like, the outcome that you want.
What's also interesting is that the change you mentioned at the top of this episode, where for the first time ever, the Ivy League is going to allow its champion to play in the FCS playoffs. For years, this was a thing. It's again, like we're just sort of playing the old time college sports hits. This was the thing the Ivy League said, we think this is a bad idea in terms of the academic calendar. Potentially, you know, if you make the FCS playoffs and you do well, you're talking about like extending your season by maybe like a month. And certainly, I think in the case of the Ivy Leagues, probably with a lot of road travel involved. I don't think it's likely that Ivy Leagues are going to be getting highly seeded. The Ivy League champions going to be getting highly
seeded. I actually disagree with you there. You think they will? I disagree with you there. I mean, just running the numbers, just looking at our friend Bill Connolly's FCS projections.
Okay.
typically he'll have Ivy League teams ending the season like 10th, 9th, 8th. In 2021, mm-hmm. they had three top 10 teams, but that was kind of a weird year. Last year, Harvard finished the season 8th. Actually, last year, Harvard was
ranked. That's still a lot of road travel that they're probably going to have to do.
Still a decent amount of. Yes. Yes. We are looking at a Yale at Montana situation.
Right.
Like, all the good schools are on the far west coast. So they would have to play, I guess, the quarters. If they finished the season ranked 9th, they would have to play the quarters and the semis on the road if they made it that far.
Right. So I guess what is curious to me is, why sort of like relent on that and say, okay, we'll let you play in this very big, potentially very long playoff, but not do any of the other things that schools do to be competitive in that. And I am sort of curious, and this is more of a like, let's watch rather than answer this question kind of thing. I wonder how the Ivy League will feel if you are putting teams into this playoff and they're getting pasted, like if they're going to Montana, yeah, if they're you know, and that happens. Well,
it's time to start dropping the bag, guys.
Yeah, yeah. I do wonder if I think there's a difference between the Ivy League is very focused, like it's largely focused on internal rivalries, not exclusively. You can find some like rivalries outside the division, or outside the conference rather. But this sort of opens you up to a wider stage and wider attention, and it becomes a little less insular. And I am curious if that doesn't work, if that will lead to change. Now, that said, I would not be surprised if the change was, well, we're going back to we're not participating in the FCS playoffs anymore.
It is. So it was actually something that was pushed through by like the student athlete advisory committee. They were like, we don't understand why you're not letting us participate in this. And the Ivy League schools, I guess, didn't have an answer. Like,
interesting.
You can play like, and it didn't really make sense because Ivy League teams play in NCAA championships in every other sport. Like they go on runs in the NCAA basketball tournament kind of every year.
Yeah.
They tend to be pretty good.
Yeah.
And they were just like, specifically, we are holding out about football. And it is true. Like part of the reason I think, so there are a couple other schools, the HBCU conferences also don't send teams to the FCS playoff. And their reasoning is, we'd rather hold our own national championship mm-hmm. and they play the Celebration Bowl against each other. And like, that means more to us than going on the road and potentially losing to a school like Montana or North Dakota State by 40, which would happen. Those schools are really good.
And sometimes you will see HBCUs, like I know this because it happened to Tennessee State last year. Sometimes you'll see
the second schools,
right. Sort of the like runners up. They'll go to the FCS playoff instead.
I think the situation there is that Tennessee State is not in one of the HBCU conferences.
They play
in a different conference now, so they were able to get an at-large bid. But yeah, there have been teams that have played. It wasn't like they were outright banned. They just decided we want our champions to play for the Black College National Championship as opposed to participating in the FCS championship. Right. Anyway, long story short, sorry to dunk on you about Tennessee State's conference realignment status, but, and you're in Nashville too. You know, fun fact, since we're on the topic, the two largest stadiums at FCS, by capacity are Yale at the Yale Bowl and Tennessee State, cause they play at the Titan Stadium.
Oh, okay.
I found that out. This Google run through that I did this morning.
Helpful to know.
Now let's forget that entirely. But it's like, yeah, the Ivy Leagues, I think what you said there is like, it was a sense that it was like, we will play each other. This will be our like championship and the rest of it doesn't matter to us. And that's sort of a way for you to continue that belief that you are superior to everyone in every way. Mm-hmm. Without actually having to put that to the test, you know, And now they have decided to put that to the test.
Let's take an ever so brief break to talk about our sponsor, Home Field Apparel. I am recording this ad a couple of days after Florida, a college football team I root for, lost at home to USF, the college football team from the city where I grew up. I have, thanks to Home Field, a lot of Florida stuff, but I don't have any USF gear. And this is not because Home Field doesn't have USF gear. They do, and they actually just released a bunch of new stuff for the Bulls. And I have no choice but to honor the only ranked college football team within a 3-hour drive of Orlando by acquiring a vintage USF Bulls long sleeve shirt, which I am pressing purchase on literally as I record this ad. Pay now. Processing. Boom. Just ordered. For too long, our apparel-based response to sports trauma has been to burn jerseys, but I am trying a different coping mechanism, and this one will be much more comfortable. Please note, I will not attempt this if and when Florida loses to Tennessee, or Georgia, or Florida State. Maybe Miami. I will think about it. Leave me alone. Okay, back to the show. So, if we're gonna circle all the way back to like your question of college football is a world where you can now spend money in much more open and legal ways and build a roster and build a program and sort of change your fortunes in ways that would not have been permissible 5 years ago. It strikes me that there are two hurdles that the Ivy League would have to deal with in its current iteration and with its current approach to make this work. Number one, go back to the broken leg test. Like, the Ivy League seems pretty set on the idea of you get admitted as a student. Athletics can put a thumb on a scale. I don't want to suggest that like it has no role whatsoever, but it's not the same thing as like there's a whole separate qualification. There's a whole separate qualification and admissions process, and we're going to have athletes who have an academic profile that is wholly inconsistent with the rest of the student body. So that's number one. Number two, if they're not using house money, and I do think, you know, without digging into it, I do think it would be tricky for them to use house money since, like, my understanding is that's specifically sort of athletics department revenue, and because of the way the Ivy League sort of conduct themselves, they're not sitting on a ton of TV money, for instance. They're not probably not sitting on a ton of branding money or things like that FBS schools might be. They would have to fund all of this through NIL. And as part of the house settlement, the part that they are, that's sort of like not a thing you can opt out of, that has to be quote unquote true NIL, where players are going and getting paid for quote unquote real work, real sort of appearance fees based on a competitive market that, you know, a third party is going to be analyzing to figure out sort of if these deals meet are sort of within an expected range. Like, how do you think this would work if the Ivy League said, okay, we would like to sort of try to like use our financial power to try to build a football team that could, let's say, win an FCS championship?
I feel like, I guess what I was arguing for was outside of the bounds of reason and more like you have a $51 billion endowment and a lot of lawyers and a lot of, I feel like people affiliated with Ivy League institutions have figured out schemes to make things work before.
Yeah.
To get around various regulations and rules.
I think geopolitics have taught us that over the last 50 to 100 years. I think that's a fair claim. Yeah.
Well, I guess the question, like, I kind of keep coming back to, and this is a broad, open-ended question, is like, so these schools started the concept of college athletics once upon a time. They started the first intercollegiate sporting event in America was a Harvard Yale rowing match.
Yeah.
The first college football game was Princeton versus Rutgers. And still in to this day, like, proving yourself against the other schools in the conference means something to them. But like, overall, what is the motivation that in general, and I'm putting this as broadly as possible, why does it matter so much to so many people for your college to be good at sports? Like, if like really open at, think about this from every angle you can.
I think it's because it's just an easy point of pride. It's a thing to be proud of, and it's an accessible and publicly, it's probably the easiest way for people to have a positive feeling about a school or a positive understanding of a school. Like, if you tell somebody who has vague understanding of college sports, oh, I went to Alabama, like the first thing they snap to is like, oh, Nick Saban, all those titles. Right?
Yeah. And the pride is in, like, what do you think the root cause of the pride is? Just like that it's that your school has these athletes, these people. Like, if you kind of think about it in a very, like, a very abstract way.
Yeah.
Like, much in the same way that, like, when a bird does an elaborate mating ritual.
Sure.
It's sure. Showing that it's not about the, it's showing that it was able to feed itself enough with the energy. Yes. That it, like, is the fittest to survive,
it's, and you should consider. It's a display of tribal power and authority and supremacy. And
but it's that. Also, I mean, it's also kind of showing that, like, you know, your school produces people that have enough disposable income that they built a $180 million practice facility.
Yes, I think your school
produces successful people.
I think that is definitely what it has turned into, 100%, yes.
Like, it's a way of showing that your people are so proud of this and doing so well in life that they were able to do something so frivolous.
It is the biggest, and it is the biggest difference, I think, between, like, caring about a professional football team and caring about a college. Like, you know, the Steelers are not going to their season ticket holders and being like, gosh, you know, if we could just build this war chest, we could get out of the wild card round or something like that. But, like, college
aren't
coaches,
you,
like, Ohio.
You proud of, yeah, sorry.
Ohio.
You proud of your time at Pittsburgh Steelers? Don't you remember when you were a kid? Wouldn't you like us to have $180?
Yeah, I mean, but Ohio State literally said this at the, it was sort of as NIL was rolling out, was like, this is a thing. This is like a point. It's, in some ways, it's kind of like raising money. It's not the same thing. I want to be very clear. But it's kind of like the same pitch for raising money for, like, a performing arts center or something. Of like, hey, we need your money to build this thing that the community will be proud of. How it manifests is obviously very different. But at a very sort of base level, the pitch is kind of the same.
So I'm just wondering, I guess. I'm not engaging with the logistical specifics of your question.
Yeah.
So much as I'm saying, like, where are these people who, you know, just want to show how much they, like, how much these schools mean to them with the billions of dollars that they donate? Why don't they just, you know, throw some of it towards the football, is all I'm saying.
So I have a theoretical answer for you. I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I want to make that very clear for anyone who had any doubts about it. You mentioned in the men's basketball tournament frequently – the Ivy League champ will win a game or two, like can or give a blue blood some stress. Like, they show out pretty effectively. I wonder if part of it is, and maybe this is why they're relenting to participate in the FCS playoffs, is there is some sense of, we're proud that we can do this in the old ways, so to speak. Like, you have your team that is built on NIL, has been plucked from the transfer portal. We think your academic standards for athletics are a joke. You have basically a team that we don't consider to be legitimate student athletes. I'm exaggerating for effect here. And we can
you're talking as a snooty Princeton.
Yes, that's
you're not
right.
Ryan
that's
Nanny
right.
Right now.
That's right.
If and, you could. If you could see him, he's holding his pinky finger up in the air.
I'm dressed as the Monopoly Man right now. But I wonder if
he went to Dartmouth.
I wonder if part of it is we take pride in that we can compete with you on a playing field that is uneven in favor of you, something that will not be true for a lot of Harvard grads going forward, and we can win or we can compete. And I do wonder if there is some sort of sense of like, that's what, in the same way that Georgia or Texas or Michigan or Notre Dame takes pride in like playing, like having a team that can play in the national championship game or can win a national championship. If what the Ivy League is peddling is like, no, you can have a team that can be competitive but doesn't have to compromise in any of these ways.
Yeah, I get. I mean, you could, yes, that sense of doing things in a particular way, like I guess, is more important overall than anything else in that mindset that defines Ivy League sports. We don't even want to throw the curveball, like
the dishonest curveball. Okay,
the dishonest.
I will say this: so the exception that exists, like it for schools that don't do athletic scholarships, have it done, are opting out of house, et cetera, et cetera. NIL is still there. So I am curious, is there a pathway where extremely wealthy, Ivy alum, Cornell alum, whoever, says, hey, I care about football, and while I'm not going to tell you we have to change all of the rules, I know this rule is acceptable, and if I can find 5 highly talented, academically qualified high school players who would maybe they would go to Boston College or maybe they would go to Duke or whatever instead of coming to Cornell, I'm going to give them like actual money to advertise for, I don't know.
My hedge fund,
my pharma concern, my real estate empire, whatever, and sort of say like, I'll play by the rules. I will like make it actual NIL. They're going to film commercials. They're going to air nationally, whatever.
My orphan stamping machine.
It does seem like if you found the right person who was motivated to do it. But then I guess my question is this, even in that scenario, do you think, and again, now we're really out on the speculative ledge, but whatever, do you think if that theoretical donor went to the Cornell Athletic Department and say like, here's the plan, I'm going to put $1 million into this so we can get like some targeted talent that sort of meets all your other criteria, but like, I want to be very clear, I'm spending this money so that they will come here and play football for us, but we're doing it in the most above board way possible. So do you think the Ivy League would be like, we're not even interested in that?
The quote from the athletic director of Princeton, John Mack, a few years ago, and was, I don't want student athletes on our rosters who are only here because we're paying them. I think overwhelmingly we will continue to find a large number of really great student athletes that find the Princeton student athlete experience really attractive. That's their line. That's their line. They're sticking to it. At the same time, like, Princeton's best basketball player is redshirting this season so he can graduate and transfer the year after that. Like, so they are not exactly...
They don't get to isolate from the whole system as much as they might want to.
Yeah, and they are going to, I mean, they'll probably view the fact that I'm talking about Caden Pierce, he was there, he made, I think he was on the team that went to a Sweet 16 a couple of years ago, so that's a win for them. But eventually, even those players who enjoyed the Princeton student-athlete experience you're talking about might have to leave because you're putting these undue restrictions on like their ability to play for a fifth year or, their ability to make money from an NIL deal. And It's really what we're talking about is like the desire to have it both ways by sticking hard and fast to your rules and your idea of what college sports should be while also winning that game and getting to say we did it our way and we still won. But that's such a rare moment, and you get the sense that it will be increasingly rare.
Yes, and it is also a moment that I think is much more feasible in basketball than in football for a variety of reasons. Like, I don't think if, you know, we lived in a world where the Ivies moved back into FBS, where they lived before the split in the 70s, and, you know, Harvard scheduled Florida, I think the rosters are so big that you couldn't, it'd be hard to see the path where it's like you can spring that upset. Basketball's a different animal.
For sure. Do you, I have a meeting to ask you about this. Do you remember when Florida had to start a transfer from Yale at quarterback last year?
This was in the Georgia, I don't think he started, but he came in and played in the Georgia game. I remember that happened.
Was it good?
It wasn't ideal. No, but on the other hand, like, it's sort of, it is somewhat illustrative that it's like, oh, somebody transferred from, and this happens all the time. Like, it's not unusual in the transfer portal to see a couple of guys come from the Ivy League and go to, like, the big name schools. They're not necessarily going for a big payout or for a starting spot, although in some cases they can do pretty well. But yeah, I mean, here is where I'll leave it, and you can sort of tell me if I'm you can tell me if you think I'm right or wrong here. I think there's one thing and only one thing that would break the dam and create the world that you want to live in, where fancy Ivy alums are spending irresponsibly on college sports. I think you need one school to break the solidarity between the Ivies. I think if you had one, to go back to my example, if you had Cornell who said, okay, we feel like this is okay. We're playing by all the rules we all agreed to, but we are going to explore this sort of like NIL path. I think that would force some hands in the rest of the Ivy League, and you would see schools soften their stance or claim that their stance was misunderstood, and you would sort of like start to see things like, weirdly, I think they're right. I do think they understand that, like, once you open this door, you cannot put this genie back in the bottle. And once you're a little bit more modern and professionalized in terms of how you compensate your roster and build your roster, it snowballs really fast. I think they're right about that.
And college sports is snowballing a little bit right
now. Yes, very much so.
And I'm not mad about it. I think I'm more on board with the changes to college sports than most people, because ultimately the old system was morally unjust. It was illegal according to the laws of the United States, which still occasionally apply to things. It doesn't bother me so much that people are transferring more, that people are getting paid more, but, you know, these schools have been so clear about what their vision of college sports is. And in some ways honest about it. They have not changed it, except in these small ways, and I think they should change some parts of it. But, like, it's true that a world where money equals wins should play into the hands of schools with all the money in the world. But they repeatedly say, like, this is the vision we've had for 150 years, and we're sticking to it.
I should note, I feel it's my responsibility to note that not everything we've brought up here is hypothetical, specifically the idea of Harvard playing Florida. This has happened twice, Roger.
I guess in the 30s, 40s?
20s. Twice in the 20s. 1922 and 1929. These are 2-0
Harvard.
These are the only two, yes, that's correct. Not only 2-0 Harvard. First of all, both these games played on the road for Florida. Harvard was not going to be bothered to come down to Gainesville if you want to play us. You haul your asses up here.
Well, dude, they didn't have planes yet. Like the travel in the 1920s was.
I hear you. Second of all, blowout like shutouts each time. 1922, Harvard wins 24-0. 1929, Harvard wins 14-0. And these were like not bad Florida teams either. Like the 29 team went 8-2. The 22 team went 7-2. You know, at different time, like, listen, one of those wins for the 22 team was against the American Legion. So there are some differences here, but this is a Florida team that beat Georgia in 29. Florida beat Georgia, Auburn, Clemson, South Carolina, Oregon.
Oregon
lost to Harvard. So,
I mean, you know, something. I think the SEC is scared. The SEC knows. Like the SEC has been positioning for years. We are going to bring this team in because it brings us more money. We are going to, you know, start this TV network because it brings us more money. We are going to expand the playoff because it brings us more money. We are going to make decision after decision after decision that increases our coffers, makes us the wealthiest conference in the sport. And then they know in the back of their head that there's a sleeping giant with more money that they could ever dream of.
So I think you're suggesting that, let's say, the SEC and the Big Ten both aggressively modernized college football and its relationship with athletes specifically to like get distance from the Ivy Leagues. So, like, we'll build a brand of football that you won't want to participate in, and then you won't shut us out anymore.
And it's going to backfire. Because then they've built a system that is so dependent on having the largest bankroll that they will just get completely wrecked when Columbia unveils its $80 million football roster.
Shit. Phantom Island is produced by Michael Serber and presented by Homefield. Our theme music by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard comes from the song Phantom Island from their album of the same name. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.